Your SteveJonesShow.com audio is coming up next. Audio and podcast of The Steve Jones Show, a service of Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, Routes 11 and 15, Hummel's Wharf.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is The Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Buhner's in the house.
Still a gorgeous day, Steve. Quick NFL update. We got word, I think, today that Henry Hynoski, Southern Columbia High School, University of Pittsburgh, has been cleared to play for the New York Giants.
Good news.
Yeah. Hank the Tank is just an incredible athlete. And good for him. You know, got to play in a Super Bowl, and he's got a touchdown last year as a fullback, mostly a blocking back. But what a great athlete.
Yeah. I played golf with his cousin, Jamie. And if they gave me a choice between playing golf with him or playing golf with her, I would rather play golf with Jamie.
Exactly.
So would I.
No offense.
That's all right. I understand that. I agree.
You know,
Jamie, of course, working at Wise Markets, of course.
And Hynoski, you know, in high school, worked extra hard to achieve and went to Pittsburgh. And then when he got his role as became basically a blocking back, he was going to be the best blocking back. And then, you know, got his degree and left Pitt a year early. But with a degree in hand, because he thought he had a chance in the NFL, and lo and behold, not only did he have a chance, he made it and was, you know, on the biggest stage. There's a famous play in the Super Bowl where he recovered a fumble and helped the Giants win. Good for him. He's back.
He's carved out a nice career, and he now gets an opportunity to keep on playing. So that's great for him, and we are looking forward to watching him perform this season. It's good to have him back. So, there we go.
Any
surprises? What?
Any surprises from the Bill O'Brien press conference of yesterday?
No. I didn't hear anything that was a surprise at all.
I do have some highlights if you'd like to hear.
Sure. Go ahead.
I was talking about Eastern Michigan here.
We've got a very tough, resilient football team. Personally, I'm going to try to do the best I can to improve this week as a head coach and do a better job offensively, defensively, and special teams.
And talked about the positives of Saturday's win.
We went into that game in MetLife Stadium with a true freshman at quarterback. I think it was 104 degrees on the field throughout the game. We didn't have our best wide receiver in the first half of the game because of what I decided to do there. Defensively, we put the defense in some tough situations.
And he also talked about the offensive line.
I thought the guys really blocked hard up front. I don't know why people think that the offensive line struggled. The offensive line, when the play was called properly and the right play was put into the game, the offensive line blocked very, very well.
And, of course, one of the keys will be to get better. They faced a team that's dead last a year ago against the run in Eastern Michigan, which I find interesting because I think Sean Kurtz is a good middle linebacker. Cy Moffmer is a very good defensive tackle. And I think Cashmer, the defensive end, is very good as well. It's not like they don't have talent over there. But Donald Coleman's going to miss the first half of the game. He came in off the edge on a sack and went helmet to helmet on the sack. He got thrown out of the game. And then that also means he has to miss the first half of the game on Saturday against Penn State.
You know, I really don't like this rule for multiple reasons. And they have the rule similar in high school now where you are ejected as well from the game. But I think it is too broad of a play to try and determine by the official whether it's intentional or deliberate or whatever. I really don't like the way the rule is set up.
don't like the fact they can use replay on it.
And that
that they can suddenly buzz down and say that that somebody's out of the game.
Well, you're replaying to create a penalty then. That's what I don't like about it.
Yeah, and I don't like that. That bothers me. And that's the part that's always bothered me, that they can do that.
But they have the same thing in high school, and I'm sorry, it's hard enough to be an official. And you know what? We've all been in the stands and thought the officials missed something somewhere along the line. There's no question about it. But to have put them in a position where they have to make a judgment again on intent, especially at the high school level, a lot of this is just poor fundamentals, not necessarily intent to lead with your helmet.
Right.
I mean, if you want to call a penalty, fine. Go ahead. Sorry. Passionate about this.
Well, no, you should be passionate about it. I agree with you.
You know,
I think that
maybe they ought to go to like hockey, where there's the 2-minute sit down penalty, there's the 5-minute, and a game misconduct. And what's wrong if they're going to do this, where they throw people out of a game? What's wrong with graduating it in terms of, well, a couple minutes for the first one, rest of the half for the next one, and then you're out on the third one or something like that? But it seems a little draconian to try and first of all ascertain intent. And as Kevin, I think, said, when it could be just poor fundamentals and not intent at all, and give the officials a little bit more of a range of penalties, like sitting out, going to the sin bin, as it's called. That's what like rugby does that for the same type of infractions. There's a 10-minute penalty for that kind of hard tackling, but you get to come back after 10 minutes. So I think it's a little bit harsh.
It's very harsh, and I know Kevin, I don't like the fact they can use replay on it. You know, you either call it when it happens or not. If you can't call, if you're not allowed to use replay on penalties, which I think is correct, to me this falls into that category and should not be used.
Exactly. And if you can't tell at full speed if this was an illegal hit, then you shouldn't be throwing a flag after the fact because of replay. And you know what? I have the same argument in the NFL. If it wasn't a penalty on the field, why should it be a fine 3 days later when you watch it in the front office? The official's right there. Let the official make the call or not make the call and stay with it.
And heaven knows we have enough officials on the field anymore. Gee, there are, what, 7 now?
I'm okay with postmortem fines. I have no problem with that. I've never had a problem with fines being levied later when they took a long look at the film. That has never bothered me, because you're trying to legislate some sort of send a message in some sort of way to players about how to play it. I don't mind that, because in the pros, you're fining.
Well, I agree with you on that point, because if there's no penalty, if it doesn't involve, it doesn't affect the outcome of a game. It affects the outcome of somebody's wallet, but not the outcome of a game like a penalty would. So if you want to review something afterwards, for example, somebody sucker punches an opposing player away from the play when none of the 7 officials are out there looking, I could understand a fine for that.
Right. I mean, there's certain things that they can and can't see at full speed. And I have no problem in the pros of finding later. You know, and obviously this is, you can hear the James Harrison in him coming out.
I just don't understand how that's different, though. I mean, I understand it's a fine and it's not a suspension or anything like that, but how is that really different when you're using replay to make a punishment? That's what you're doing during the game, although it's, there's a different punishment involved. I understand that. But the basics of it is the same thing.
I don't want replay used during, where they stop the game and all of a sudden the guy gets thrown out. It's a penalty.
Totally agree.
I don't understand. I'm not for that at all. In the pros, I don't mind them finding later, because they're pros. I mean, so you can find them later.
What's the purpose of the suspension? Wasn't the 15-yard penalty enough? I mean,
if they're saying that there was intent, well, if there's intent, there has to be, you know, a more severe penalty than that.
But the question is, how do you decide whether there's intent? That's the real problem.
Well, if you're leading with your helmet,
yeah.
You know, obvious what your intent is, isn't it?
It's just the same in criminal law when you're trying to define intent in simple assault. You know, did the action of the actor cause the intended result? That's really what you're looking at.
Yeah, but there's no chance to prove reasonable doubt in this case, Bob.
No, and right. You don't have a jury deliberating with a judge either.
Right.
Right, and that's part of it. No, there's no question about that.
I'm fine with the 15-yard penalty. I think the suspension part at any level is a little bit much. You know, I thought it was a little bit much 2 years ago. Was it last year or 2 years ago where the NCAA instituted the rule if your helmet came off, and I think they did this at all levels too now, if your helmet comes off, you have to be out for one play.
Yeah, that drove me crazy.
Well, I'm sorry. I could tell you one thing. There were a lot of guys that were trying to make sure that the tacklers, or the running back's helmet came off when they made the tackle because they knew he'd be out for one play.
Yeah, they had to really strap them on last year because early on. Well, I mean, Derek Day had to miss a play last year, the first game against Ohio University, because of that.
I remember Joe Susan after the first game at Bucknell. They had four helmets fly off in the first half. He goes, I think we're going to bolt them on at halftime.
Yeah. Can you blame them?
I know it's a safety thing. Both of these rules are there for safety. But I just think sometimes you can take them too far.
Well, and I think they have to find a fine line between what is safe and what is still good football. How about that?
Well,
they haven't found that line
yet.
Let's take the NFL, for example. All right, the high hits are now being fined on are now being flagged on a regular basis. So what are the guys doing? They're going low, and now there's a bunch of knee injuries being discussed. So now you've narrowed down the quote unquote strike zone as between the shoulders and basically the hip or the belt.
Right.
How much more? I mean, what are you going to do? Put a little target on their waist and say, if you don't hit this target, it's going to throw off a sensor and it's going to be a 15-yard penalty.
Right. You know, and I understand that. I understand that. So, you know, they've got to find the fine line.
And
somewhere.
I think, don't you think it's really, they're really struggling with this? I mean, trying to maintain the game of football as a contact sport, but yet when you see retired NFL players with brain scans that show all kinds of serious injury from a lifetime of football, they want to prevent that, but they also want to maintain it. And trying to find that balance is, I think, where they are right now. And it's such a fine, Steve, as you and Kevin both said, it is a fine line. And they're just going to keep working at it and adjusting the rules, which is one of the benefits that the NFL can do because they can change the rules. This is not like the U.S. Constitution where you need three-quarters of the states to ratify it. The owners get together, the rules get changed.
All right, and that's what you look at. But again, they see with the difference with the NFL and college, they had the ability to fine in the NFL.
Yes.
And the ability to fine, I think, means everything. And as opposed to, you know, when you look at college, you can't do that. You can't fine people.
We're taking your lunch money.
Yeah.
Well, no training table for you.
What they do in the, yeah, exactly. In the NFL, what they do, the money all goes to charity, so.
Do they ever, just as an aside, I've always been wondered about that. Number one, is there ever an accounting as to who gets all this charitable money? Do the teams decide? So when a New
No.
York Giant gets fined, does it go to the Giants' charity or does it go to the NFL charity? I've always...
No, I think they distribute it equally among all NFL charities. I think that's how they do it when the season's over with, including like the Play 60 program and things like
mm-hmm.
that. You know, before it used to be like the United Way and so forth.
James Harrison must have had a lot of deductions.
Yeah, is that tax deductible when you get fined? We need to get ask an accountant on that one.
No, it's not.
I know.
The league made the contribution, not James.
Yeah.
So.
Sounds like very shortly we're going to be joined by John Cappelletti if what Kevin says he's been able to pull off.
I'm hoping so.
And I guess the question I have for Cappy is, are you going to be in Happy Valley this weekend?
Yeah, he will be. That'll
be great.
That's why we're doing this. So we're looking forward to it. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back more on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Ready for a quality pre-owned vehicle? Well, get them before they go to auction at Sunbury Motors. Go to sunburymotors.com and click on pre-auction blowout.
Like a Ford Fiesta four-door sedan, SEL, $11,995. 2006 Pontiac Solstice two-door convertible, super low miles, only $15,521. A one-owner 2011 Hyundai Sonata 2.4-liter hybrid for just $17,387. 2012 Ford Econoline cargo van, fully serviced, $18,996. 2010 Ford Explorer Sport Track four-door, $24,352, and a 2011 Lincoln MKX with a six-year, 100,000-mile warranty, just $34,882. Call 888-536-8017.
All come with a Carfax report and our lowest price promise. Pre-auction blowout. 24/7 at sunburymotors.com, at the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at our dealership, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sunbury Motors, a tradition of trust since 1915.
All right, thanks to Merrill Reese who joined us in the opening half hour. John Cappelletti is going to join us at 4:35 following the news. Looking forward to having the 1973 Heisman Trophy winner on. The 73 reunion is this weekend. It'll take place here at Penn State for the 40th anniversary of college football's first ever 12-0 team. And, of course, John won the Heisman, which is Penn State's only Heisman Trophy. I've told you the story about maybe 2-3 years ago, Truman on the press box side, he always gives Jack a hard time every time we go in because Jack, you know, it used to be he didn't have a pass. Now he has a pass because he always gave his pass to Moeller. So we're going in, and John Cappelletti's right in front of him. John Cappelletti's right in back of us. He's going to sit on the press box side. So we go through security, whatever, and all of a sudden there's John, and Truman takes the ticket, and he swipes the ticket, and it doesn't register. He swipes it again. It doesn't register. So John very politely says, well, why don't you try this ticket? So he tries the second ticket. He swipes it, and nothing happens. Right? He says, well, all right, well, how about this one? He swipes it, and that one doesn't happen. I look back and said, Truman, for crying out loud, he's the only Heisman Trophy winner in the history of the school. Let him in. And Truman goes, okay. John looks over and says, thanks, Steve. after a while, we have so many stupid rules.
Exactly.
he's got four tickets in his hand, and he's the Heisman Trophy winner standing in line. Let him in.
Yeah.
I don't think he's a security risk.
No.
I mean, really.
But Truman, you are right. It starts to border on the absurd, doesn't it, at times?
Well, we've lost all semblance of common sense.
Yeah.
You put in all these rules and so forth, and it gets to the point where you should be telling people what they can do instead of what they can't do. Mm-hmm. Because it might be shorter. might be a shorter list.
I hope somebody tips off the ticket taker this weekend that John Cappelletti's back in town. So
I think they'll be okay. And I don't think they're going to be sitting on our side this time. I think they're going to be on the luxury suite side.
Oh.
I told you that one about Jack looked over the first night and he says, they showed Franco Harris, I think, in a box. He goes, oh, there's my teammates, Franco Harris and Lynn Swan. He says, wow, looks like there's a lot of teak wood over there. I said, yes, and you're over here with me where there's a lot of press board.
Yeah.
Yeah. Swan went from the field to the luxury suites. Jack went from the field to the teak wood.
Yeah, so it's like sitting there like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Well, I told you the story about Irv Pankey, who played 20 years in the NFL, and his two sons were playing for Oregon State. And I said something about the fact that Irv is now an assistant coach at a junior college. I said, part-time. I said, you can do stuff like that. I said, when you have that great NFL pension. And Jack looks over. He says, not everybody got that pension. He says, yeah, I know. He says, how do you know? I said, because you're sitting here with me. So we have fun.
Yes, you do.
Oh, well, I told you about the hotel thing the other day, didn't I?
No.
I don't think so. I don't remember the hotel thing.
Well, I had offered to take him back to the hotel after the game. I said that to him during the week because he was going to go down to Philadelphia, meet Joanne, and go to Maine. I said, no problem. I'll have my car. I'll just take you back to the hotel. Well, O'Brien decides to do a walkthrough in the stadium on Friday. Of course, I drove in, so I wasn't part of this. So they go over, and Jack stays on the bus, and he looks over across the parking lot, and there's the Sheraton Meadowlands. And he's like, you got to be kidding me. He says, look how close the hotel is. There's the Sheraton right there. He says, oh, that's a big favor. Then they get on the bus, and they pull out of the parking lot, and they go past the Sheraton Meadowlands, and they keep on going because they went to Weehawken. And he says, with each mile, I start saying to myself, I take it back. I take it back. I take it back. He says, I looked for the first time. It's a wedge from the stadium to the hotel. A wedge. I said, yeah, now your driver in Threewood, how do you feel? Don Cappelletti next. Here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Q, it's 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. We anticipate at some point this half hour to have former Heisman Trophy winner Don Cappelletti on the show. In fact, we'll probably have him on in just a few moments. Looking forward to that very, very much. And getting him back here to Happy Valley to talk about one of the truly great teams in the history, not just of Penn State, but of college football. The 1973 team that went 12-0, the first ever team in the history of college football to go 12-0. So this is what we're looking forward to and anticipating in this half hour. They will be having their 40th reunion this weekend. It's one of the big reasons why it should come out and be a part of the game on Saturday.
Steve, besides Cappelletti, who are some of the other players that Penn State people will remember from that undefeated team?
Jimmy Donches, Tom Schumann. I think Schumann's being honored in Harrisburg this fall. Schumann was the quarterback. Chuck Hurd, who made one of the truly great catches in the history of any bowl game you'll ever see. It's a one-handed catch over the middle. It went 72 yards for a touchdown against LSU. Gary Heyman, Mark Markovich.
Yeah, lineman, wasn't he? Mark was a lineman.
He was a guard. Eddie O'Neill, Randy Crowder, Mike Hartenstein. Those were all members of that team. That's how good they were. Listen to the names and the talent. Team.
Randy Crowder, I think he was from Sharon, Pennsylvania, maybe?
Yeah, and being in the NFL, played for many years in the NFL, then eventually came back here. He's actually an offensive line coach briefly here, even at Penn State. So, they were loaded with talent. Markovich was a second-round pick of the Chargers. O'Neill was a second-round pick of the Lions. Hartenstein ended up being a second-round pick of the Bears.
Yeah.
John was, of course, a first-round pick with the LA Rams. I mean, they just had so many guys off that team. Donches was picked by the Bills. They just had so many guys on that team that were really good. I mean, Heyman ended up getting picked by Buffalo. Turd worked for many years in the Keller Conference Center. Many, many years.
Hartenstein became a legend in Chicago. I just happened to know that from a mutual friend that went to Penn State with him and followed his career later. He was just amazing.
Yeah, just a great player, and all part of that legacy of what was a great football team. in 1970. Just really, really good. And, I mean, that's part of that, you know, Joe gave the national championship rings, if I recall correctly.
And didn't they have about a – what was their winning streak at the time? It just wasn't those 12 games, was it?
No, it was 12 games because what happened – and I'm going to bring this up with John.
Okay.
You know, should we get him on the line? Penn State opened the 72 season. John had played defense in 71. He'd been on the freshman team in 70. 71, he played defense. They moved him to tailback in 72. He gained over 1,100 yards. They lost the opening game at Tennessee.
That's
and then
right.
They go through the season, they win their next, 10 games, and then they're going to play Oklahoma in the Sugar Bowl, and John got really sick the night before the game and couldn't play the game. Couldn't play it. And Oklahoma won the game 14-0. The irony is Oklahoma, quote, had to vacate the win because they used two ineligible players in the game, including the quarterback, who was a backup quarterback a lot. So when they went 12-0, that was a two-game streak. And we now welcome in true Penn State royalty along the way. Did we lose him there, Kevin?
It appears so, yeah.
Nice job, Kevin.
Thank you very much. Happy to do it.
Nice job. Anything else you can do here in this segment?
How about we take five?
No, how about you just take the call and we'll get this done. He wants to sprinkle water from words on the phone.
Yes.
Well, we're having a little bit of a connection issue between here and California.
Would you like me to take five?
Would you please?
I'll take five. We'll come back with more on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Welcome back. Steve Jones Show for a Wednesday. We're joined by a man who won the Heisman Trophy 40 years ago and whose team will be suited at halftime at Beaver Stadium, John Cappelli. John, welcome. It's great to have you with us.
Thanks, Steve. Nice to be on.
John, what does the reunion weekend mean to you? I mean, something that's happened before, but what does this particular weekend mean?
Well, we've had them before. I think it started at about 25 years, and we've had them consistently every 5 years since, and I've always been able to make it back. And I think it's just about getting together with the guys that you played with and, you know, the memories that you have. And 40 years seeming like it's been only about 4 years when you kind of turn around with, you know, raising your own family, doing your own thing. Not everybody lives in the same area anymore. And so getting together is a special thing because of, you know, that relationship we had when we were players. And it really is a special bond, and it kind of carries on for life.
Everyone, of course, talks about the Heisman, which we'll talk about in a few moments. But I think a lot of people don't realize that this was the first year you were allowed to play 11 regular season games. Penn State was the first team to ever go 12-0. What meaning does that have to you and the guys?
Well, it was nice. I think a few of the guys actually, you know, realized that in real time, and kind of, you know, that was kind of a goal. We knew that the teams before the 68-69 teams, there were, you know, there was undefeated teams, but they're always 11-0, and we had the opportunity to get that extra game, and if we won a bowl game, we would be 12-0. That would be unprecedented, and maybe even have a shot at a national championship. But I think it was important that we kind of, you know, broke new ground in that area.
And it was the first team ever in college football, period, to go 12-0, because Notre Dame won the title that year at 11-0. But you ended up fifth in the poll. But Joe gave you rings. What did it mean that he gave you rings?
Well, I think it just meant, you know, he was, you know, college football, you know, is as good as it is in some areas, is still a little bit lacking in other areas. And I think it was just, you know, he really believed that, you know, we were the best team. We had the best record of anybody in the country, and we probably could have played on the same field with just about anybody. And I think it was his way of saying that, you know, it's not up to everybody else. And I think after the 69 thing with Nixon, that Joe had enough and, you know, felt like, hey, we're going to take control of this. We're going to give these kids something to remember this season by, even if nobody else recognizes it.
You come here, freshman, of course, camp you're a defensive back in 71. In 70, you get your crack at tailback. After they lose the opener, you then run 10 straight at that point. You could not play in the bowl game because you were sick. How tough were the emotions following that, that you couldn't play in the game, and how much did that mean to your offseason?
Well, that was probably the most difficult thing I had to handle at Penn State. I mean, I had to handle some tough stuff as a sophomore, which you probably know.
Yes.
But missing the game, letting the team down, having Walt Addy had to step in at the last minute because, you know, I was fine during the week, and I don't know if it was just a really bad virus or food poisoning or what it is, but it hit me like a ton of bricks, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. And so that was almost to the point where, you know, I felt so bad. It probably made me even more determined for the next year. If anything good came out of it, it was that, you know, I need to come back even stronger and better than I was this year.
The opener was against Stanford, good football team. Did you feel like that set the tone for what you wanted to do?
Yeah, Stanford was a good team that year. They were a good test for us, and we had to travel to the coast to do it. Came back a little bit beat up from that game, actually. They were a pretty good football team, and it was a pretty good game. I think going into the season, a lot of guys knew that we had the ability, we had the capability to do something a little bit more special, a little bit more unique, as long as we focused and we took those one games at a time, as Coach told us we would have to anyway. But yeah, I think we felt that this was, we were on the doorstep of something that could be possible that was never done before.
As Joe always said, and Bill talks about as well, every team takes on its own personality, and we know the leadership on the 2012 team was exceptional. Discuss the leadership on your team and also the personality of that team.
Well, I think the personality was, a lot of guys that just wanted to, you know, go to work every day, practice every day, get better every day. That was just the nature of the way things were a little bit more back then. It was more of what can we do for the team? How can we get better individually so the team is better? It was guys like Bobby Nagel who blocked for me that last senior season. And how many times did that guy have to run into somebody because, you know, I was running the ball and they knew I was running the ball, so it made it even tougher. So I think the attitude was that of just, you know, a blue collar mentality. And, you know, then we had other guys that were, you know, had a little bit more personality, you know, a little bit more, could talk to Joe a little bit more, get things done for the team, maybe a request for something that we were lacking, which, you know, in those days, you didn't ask too much. You just did what you were asked to do. And so I think it was just a good combination of a lot of guys that wanted to work hard and a few guys that, you know, could, you know, voice the opinion of the group.
Also, you mentioned and referenced in a previous answer about the frustration of 71 and playing defense, and I brought up the 72 bowl game. Did that really fuel how hard you ran because you finally got your chance to show it?
Well, I was, you know, after that sophomore year when things really, you know, didn't go well. If I would have stayed in that position for another year or two, they probably would have moved me to linebacker anyway, but things did not go well. And then as a junior, I lost all that time in practice as a sophomore. And so I really didn't get any better as a running back. You know, we only played three games as a freshman team. So I really didn't get that much better as a running back because I lost that year. So I was behind the eight ball, and I think it was the fourth game of the season. It was still kind of Gary Heyman, maybe me, you know, running the, you know, we were both in the game, in and out of the game, until like the fourth game. I think it was Illinois at Champaign that I had a kind of a breakout game, and the light went off for me, and I felt like, okay, now I can do this. I can play at this level. I can be comfortable at this level, and I can get better, you know, every game.
And then you talk about getting in the groove, light going on. When you had the three straight 200-yard rushing games, what was the common thread and the feeling in that huddle as you went through those three straight 200-yard games?
Well, you know, we just did what we were, capable of doing. Running the ball was what we did. Even though Tom Schumann, who was had a good arm and had a good season the next year, and he was kind of the leader on our offense as far as being the quarterback, we just were built to run the ball. We had some big offensive linemen, and I think, Joe just got a, he got a feel for the game. If you look at the stats, too, that, each game we ran the ball a little bit more than the game before. So with us being able to do that and people not being able to stop us, our mentality was, hey, let's run the ball. And obviously the yards start to pile up. If you carry the ball 20 times and for 5 yards a carry, you get 100 yards. If you carry it 40 times, you get 200. So that was kind of the mentality. And we did that one game. I think it was like 41 times for a couple hundred over a couple hundred yards. But, we felt like we could run the ball. I think the toughest test, we had all season was when we played in the Orange Bowl. That LSU defense was a little bit more mobile, a little bit more quicker than what we were used to. And our size almost worked against us a little bit, but in most cases, we could run the ball.
The Heisman today, it's a show. How did you find out you won the Heisman?
We were taping the Bob Hope All-American Show back then that he put on every year, and a representative from the Heisman Trophy came down to the studio because we were taping in New York, came down to the studio, made, I had finished my part of, the little thing you do with Bob. And he said, hey, you got to come down to the athletic club. You're voted to win the Heisman. And then Bob Hope and I, like it was nothing, got into the back of a limo, and we were down at the downtown athletic club within a few minutes.
That often happens to all of us, John. They just get in the limo with Bob Hope and go to the downtown athletic club.
It was a lot to absorb in a very short period of time.
Did you write the full speech out, or did you bullet point it and ad lib the Joey part?
I am typically a bullet point guy. I'll ad lib in between bullet points. I'm very methodical in my approach as far as chronological order sometimes. The thing for Joey was just the bullet point of something for Joey. And, didn't know what that was going to be, obviously. So that part of it was never really thought out too much. Everything leading up to that, and again, because there were so many people involved and so many thank yous that had to get out, I was kind of focused on that at the beginning. Standing up in front of, that crowd and, giving a speech, was difficult enough. And so I had to focus on the beginning of it more than the end of it.
Yeah, in 2000, I think it was 7 or 8, I was there when you gave the speech to the crowd when Joe went into the Hall of Fame in that gathering that we had that night. And again, it was brilliantly and eloquently done. And only a few of us got a chance to see that one. But again, I could tell you just kind of, you knew what you wanted to say.
That was interesting because that was the one in New York. I'm assuming you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that was the one that night in New York. We were there. Yeah.
Yeah. I had just flown in. I had time to get changed, and I came down there. Obviously, wanted to be there, and that was a good night. That was a fun night, and Joe was honored, by a lot of people that night, and a lot of people said things, good things about him, and it was just a fun night. So I was glad I could be there for that.
When you see what Bill O'Brien has done in his first year and now moving forward, how excited are you about the future of Penn State football, considering you're part of the foundation that helped put it in the spot?
Well, I'm very excited. I like Bill O'Brien. I mean, what's not to like? He came in and took a job, in difficult circumstances, to say the least. And even after he committed to do that, there were still other sanctions that were being handed down, which handicapped him even further. But, I look at Bill O'Brien and I see an awful lot of new school because of the way he runs, the offense and how progressive he is with certain things and having coached at the next level. He has that experience. But I also see a lot of old school in him, too, and I think he's a really good combination of those two things. And, you know, he certainly seems to, command discipline from the kids, hard work from the kids, at the same time, you know, put him in a position on Saturday just by game plan to be able to be more successful. So I'm already a big fan, and I haven't even been back for a game yet. So I'm looking forward to this one.
By the way, the website is johncappelletti73heisman.com. That's johncappelletti73heisman.com. John, always an absolute pleasure, and can't wait to see you Saturday.
Thanks, Steve. Take care.
John Cappelletti won the Heisman in 1973, Penn State's only Heisman winner, and one of the true greats. I mean, we talk about part of the royalty of Penn State football. He is all of that and more. We thank everyone for joining us today here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Of course, it'll be on our podcast. You can listen to it later here on News Radio 1070.